Blog Talk Radio.
And we welcome you on this Monday, May 4th, 2015, on this beautiful 85-degree and sunny day. It's 85 here, Luke. Just, I've been saying cold temperatures forever, and here we are, it's 85. To teeing it up with Jeremy Shung on this Players Week, we will be joined by Ryan Ballinger to preview the players. Coming up in a couple minutes, but first we are joined by one of the voices of the Binghamton Mets. He is Luke Morrow. Hello, sir.
Good evening. And in regards to the weather, now things have really changed. You know, I was in Florida, you were in colder weather. Well, now being in Binghamton, New York, yeah, I've had to suffer through the colder weather of late.
What's the current conditions up there like now?
Well, let me tell you, today it is beautiful. It's probably close to 80 here. It was a very nice weekend, but these past 3 days have been the three nicest days of the year. And it wasn't too long ago, about a week ago, that it was still, you know, 30 degrees one day, and I was wearing my winter coat around. So it looks like that's finally passed, and we got some beautiful weather, especially for baseball here.
The Mets, the New York Mets, are off to a hot start. People thought that the pitching would be big, and it has. They've gotten some untimely injuries. They've had to call up some guys from the minors, but the Major League club has gotten off to a really good start and has Met fans thinking maybe finally this is the year. Obviously, that's had implications on you guys down in AA, but A, what's your impressions of the Major League Mets, and B, how are the Binghamton Mets?
The Binghamton Mets are off to a pretty good start as well, 14-9 as we play on here today, entering tonight's ball game. So the B-Mets off to a good start, just had a season-high six-game winning streak snap yesterday, but they're playing well. The New York Mets, you know, they lost five of their last six. The offense is sputtering, but they've had so many injuries to overcome, and we talked before the year started when you had me on. And I thought heading into the season, you know, this could be a good Mets team. I thought they could compete for the playoffs. I didn't see that great start that they got off to coming, but I still think that they are a very good squad that can compete for the playoffs. They just got to get some guys healthy and maybe some others to step up in the meantime.
How have the injuries at the major league level impacted you guys at the AA level?
A couple of different ways. It's made things more interesting in certain ways. In that one, you're on the lookout to see who's going to be called up, because they could either be former B-Mets or current B-Mets, and that's always fun to see and exciting for the organization. And also, you know, just for the rehabbers that we would get, that's the most exciting for the fans around this area. A lot of New York Mets fans here, and that's always big news. So we had Vic Black here rehab. We may see him again now after he's been shut down. We'll see what the rehab plan is for him once he starts throwing and is ready to go into games. We thought maybe we'd get Bobby Parnell, but then he re-injured himself while rehabbing in St. Louis. He never made it up to AA. So when he starts throwing again, maybe we'll see Parnell. And then, of course, David Wright is going to have to rehab. He's already in St. Louis, but the Mets faithful in this area are hoping that he'll make his way to Binghamton before returning to Citi Field. Already in St. Louis right now, I think it may the most sense for him to just play with the St. Lucie Mets, especially if they're saying it's only going to be one or two games. It's a matter of, you know, just getting a little bit of a feel back for playing in a game, not so much working your way back against competitive pitching. But, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed. That'd be a real thrill if David Wright were to rehab here. So, you know, those are three guys in particular that had a lot more injuries, and we'll see the trickle-down effect. But so far, Vic Black has rehabbed here, and we may see a couple more.
And obviously, Travis d'Arnaud, the Mets catcher, will have to come through the rehab ranks at some point, too. Is it kind of weird, Luke, that, you know, here you are as a broadcaster and here you are as the Binghamton Mets organization and the Binghamton Mets fans, and you don't want to see injuries at the Major League club, but it's almost like you're hoping for a couple because that's what can bring some excitement and some people to the ballpark besides the stuff from the usual squad.
Yeah, I don't think anyone, you know, wishes for injuries, but I think the fans certainly for the B-Mets, when there are injuries, then they start wishing and hoping that those guys will, you know, make it through Binghamton, come through Binghamton on their rehab outings. And, you know, and it's good for business for any minor league team to have a major league guy. That just adds more interest and usually more fans in the ballpark. And it's good for the minor league players, too, to share a locker room with a big leaguer, with a guy like, say, David Wright, you know, for, if he rehabs with St. Louis Mets, for those guys to be able to share the field in the locker room and the dugout with him and learn some things from him. And, of course, the big league guys are always very generous. They take care of the minor leaguers in their time there. So, you know, you never wish injuries on anybody. But when they do happen, some people or organizations can reap benefits, and the players can turn it into a positive for everyone else involved.
Absolutely. Two kind of extensions of that. Number one is, who have you seen on other squads come through yet? And number two, if you have, it's almost a good opportunity for the guys on the current AA squad to see how they perform against Major League caliber pitching.
Yeah, we absolutely. And we haven't seen, I don't believe we've seen anybody rehabbing on a visiting team yet. We've kind of missed out on those opportunities. We're playing the Portland Sea Dogs right now, Red Sox affiliate. Shane Victorino is expected to join them this weekend after they leave here. Bowie just got Ryan Flaherty and J.J. Hardy today on a rehab assignment. We're not facing them anytime soon. But a lot of teams will have guys rehab for home games, and they won't make them go through the travel, especially the Eastern League. There's a lot of bus rides for about 5, 6, 7 hours. So, you know, you don't want to put some of your guys through that, put them back on a bus when they're dealing with an injury. So we haven't faced somebody directly. There have been quite a few good names rehabbing so far in the Eastern League this year. But on top of that, you know, we just faced New Hampshire Fisher Cats, and they had four former big leaguers in their bullpen, not on rehab, just on the AA roster. So that was a good test for the BMACs and for anybody that faces the Fisher Cats. They were one of the oldest teams in the league, plenty of experience, and that's a great opportunity for some of the young guys in AA. But some names like that that come through are cool to see. And also a lot of the managers managers and coaches are former players that have been fun and interesting to get to meet as well.
Talking with Luke Mara, one of the voices of the Binghamton Mets, a couple things here. Number one, do you see when the major league club is playing better, do you see a trickle-down effect in terms of attendance and fan excitement at the AA level, or are those two things more independent because of the fact that so much of a minor league crowd is locals and families and people who would probably come out there no matter if it is David Wright or David Smith?
Yeah, I think that could certainly play into it, but I think there's a lot of things that do go into that, you know, whether it's location, like, for example, the New and Rockheads or the Colorado Rockies. And I don't think there's a single Rockies fan in the state of Connecticut. So I think location has to do with it. That's why it's nice to have the New York Mets team in Binghamton here, 3 hours from the stadium, a lot of Mets fans in the area. So I don't know if it directly impacts it. I think it definitely contributes. The big thing, whether it was with Daytona Cubs last year or the Binghamton Mets this year, there's just a lot of buzz because they both have very good farm systems. And you know, when you come to the ballpark, you're going to see great talent night in and night out from both the Cubs or the B-Mets and even a lot of their opponents as well. So I think that's the real exciting thing for these teams is that as well as the big league clubs are doing now this season for both Chicago and New York, it's even more exciting to see these teams because of the talent that they have coming up and to be able to see them before they make it to the big leagues.
Talking with Luke Morrow here, a couple other things that we'll get to. Number one, as a Vikings fan, do you like what they did?
I love the draft. I saw a lot of people saying that, you know, they had one of the best drafts in the league. I saw a couple of guys say they had the best draft of any team in the league this year. But I really liked it. Rick Spielman always wants 10 picks. He was able to get his 10 picks by making a couple trades over the weekend. I liked that the early picks all went to defense. They got positions that they needed, and I think they got very talented players. Some good steals. And in Mike Zimmer's 2 years with the Vikings, I really liked the two drafts he's had, and I think he's going to turn that defense. They already made such a huge jump last year from the previous year before Zimmer, and I think maybe not this year, but maybe as early as next season, they'll have one of the top defenses in the league.
Talking with the great Luke Morrow here. Luke, Teddy Bridgewater gave the call for riders up at the Kentucky Derby. He was joined at the Derby by basically the entire Patriots team, it seemed like. When you see Teddy Bridgewater, who's obviously a local Louisville guy, getting this kind of publicity in his hometown, it must feel good for you, because the Vikings, this side of Brett Favre, have had such an unstable situation at quarterback, and maybe you really have found somebody that can settle into that job for a while.
Well, I certainly hope so. Yeah, you know, anytime you hear about the Vikings, it's usually something bad. Favre and the whole off-field stuff he had to deal with later on. The stadium collapsing, coaches getting fired, Randy Moss coming and going, all that sort of stuff. It's always bad publicity for the Vikings. So Teddy Bridgewater seems to have a good head on his shoulders. He's a big, good guy. And I think both on and off the field, he could be a big asset to the Vikings. I was really impressed with his rookie year. And the way he's carried himself off the field, I think, is just an just as impressive. So it was funny to see him at the Kentucky Derby and see him kind of let loose a little bit, because he's always been very serious around the game of football, and that's the only way I've seen him, whether it's interviews or on TV or whatnot. So nice to see him enjoying himself. But as a collective group, I think Vikings fans are excited about Bridgewater heading into year two.
And then just to get back to baseball here, the minor leagues experimenting with some drastic pace of play rules, including a pitch clock. How's it working out?
I guess overall it's been good, but I said it when they implemented it that I don't think the issue is in the minor leagues. So, you know, I don't have the data. I haven't looked at the data in terms of time of games, if it's really had a big effect from this year to last year. But, I mean, players stepping out, pitchers taking a lot of time, that doesn't happen a whole lot in the minors. So
I don't know if it will have a big effect. I'd have to look at the numbers. But in terms of just like adjustment period, there hasn't really been an issue. There was one play yesterday where one team thought a strike should have been assessed because the batter was taking too long. But otherwise, it seems like everybody's been abiding by the rules and following the time put in. The biggest problem, I think, for minor league baseball on the pitch clock is just the time in between innings that they cut out. And then that hurts a lot of promotions, which then hurts the fan experience and even the team itself. So that's something that I think maybe gets overlooked for minor league baseball and the pitch clock, and maybe the biggest change.
That's interesting. How much time between innings?
220, I believe it is. So I know, you know, teams have had to cut certain promotions that they do that may be popular just because they don't have enough time. So it's changed the experience, not necessarily for the worse, but it's changed things.
And just to clarify, that's 220 between innings. That was mandated by Major League Baseball as using the minor leagues as a guinea pig. From what you understand, if Major League Baseball had not said it's 220, what would the in-between inning number have been?
I think it would have to be a little longer, because within that 220, by the time the clock gets to 45 seconds, that's when the music needs to be off. The announcement for the first batter needs to be made, and you have to be getting ready for the first pitch of the inning. So really, you take away 45 seconds from that 220 to begin with in terms of how much time you have in between innings, and that clock starts, you know, pretty quickly after the final out. So you have to hurry up and get out on the field, and then on top of that, you have really about 90 seconds to do whatever promotion. So, I don't know where exactly the 220 came from, but I think for minor league baseball, it may be better off if it was a little longer.
Final thing. A-Rod hit 660 in Fenway. When you saw that, what went through your head?
Oh, that was terrible. I mean, to lose a game on that, and for the fact that it happened at Fenway, it was just awful. But what a terrible at-bat. A-Rod's always had success against Gazzella. He threw three pitches, not even close to the zone, and then had a groove, a softball down the middle. And you're just asking for trouble, and that's how you lose the game. So that was terrible. I didn't get to see it live, but when I saw it afterwards, that hurt.
Our friend, our colleague, my co-host for Teeing Up Presents NFL Sunday Sprint, Mr. Luke Mara, one of the voices of the Binghamton Mets from the ballpark in Binghamton. Have a good broadcast, and thank you for joining us as part of your pregame routine on Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling.
Thank you very much. Yes, my pleasure.
We are now live from the studios of Teeing It Up in the Swamps of Jersey. It's down from 85 degrees to 82 degrees. I don't think anyone's complaining. And coming up momentarily, we'll be joined by our great friend Ryan Ballinger to preview the players golf's unofficial fifth major, whatever you want to call it, Bear Championship, Players Championship, coming up this week from TPC Sawgrass in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, coming off Rory McIlroy's win last week at the Cadillac Match Play, and also coming off Jordan Spieth's historic win back a month ago, a little under a month ago, at Augusta. So we got those two pillars, those two men who a lot of people would like to see coming down the stretch on Sunday at the stadium course. And then we have the other golf storylines that we always have, which is Tiger and his first start since Augusta and since the issue with the wrist on number nine. Phil, who was applauding the format of the match play, excited to play in the match play, and kind of just didn't show up and withdrew at the last minute from the match play, which was kind of weird. Ricky Fowler, who played well last week before having one bad swing at a bad time. Adam Scott, the rest of the gang is all back together, except for Kevin Stadler, Tim Clark. Not David Thomas, Tim Clark. Wrong T. Victor Dubuisson, Justin Hicks, and Stuart Appleby, who all qualified for the players but will not be there due to injury. We will be joined by Ryan momentarily after what was a really impressive performance over the weekend from Rory McIlroy, coming back from all these deficits and winning 17 and 18 so well and so consistently and nagging his 10th PGA Tour victory on the five-year anniversary of his first, basically. And we welcome in from the Golf News Net and a contributor to Yahoo Golf's Devil Blog Golf, whatever that thing is called. I can't think of it at the moment. Blog, it is Ryan Ballingy. Hello, Ryan.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
All right, let's start with the other golf headline of the weekend. I'm sorry. A long couple of days, I completely forgot what that site was called. The other golf headline, which is the Keegan Bradley Miguel Angel Jimenez near fight on Saturday night. That was fun, Ryan. What was your take on that?
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. My other takeaway is that Keegan Bradley looks bad. Steve Hale looks even worse. And Miguel Angel Jimenez was completely in the right. Because
really?
A player, especially in a match play situation, has every right to question a drop or question a ruling given by a rules official. Because at the end of the day, in match play, the two players have to agree what the rules are. Pretty much nobody else has to. So if Jimenez thought that one of two drops that Bradley took was wrong or in the wrong spot, then he is perfectly welcome to come over and figure out what the drop is, or question what's going on. And that Bradley hopped in Jimenez's face, and it just looked absolutely silly on their end. And I think Jimenez held himself up really well, to be honest. I mean, he didn't back down, but he also didn't escalate things. It was Bradley who did that. And in the end, I think he looked bad. So score another one for the Europeans, I guess.
Ryan, the thing that I don't get about that whole squabble is that does Jimenez have every right to walk back there? Yes. However, Keegan, by the rules of golf, is absolved of any wrongdoing as soon as the official is there, even if he gets wrong information or a bad ruling from the official. Per my understanding of what Mark Russell said, he took one drop from the TIO. It went back into the area that was still covered by the TIO. He took a second drop. That ended up on the cart path. And somehow in there, that's when him and Keegan had the problems. Him and Jimenez had the problem. And then after all that, he took relief from the cart path. It seemed like it was, if Mark is correct, and it was three total drops, it was the drop that bounced back towards the TIO area that caused the problems. It seemed like at that point, though, Jimenez can walk over, but because Keegan is absolved by the official, why would he have to open his mouth? That's the part that I don't get.
Yeah, that's a fair question, and you're right. I mean, as you said, if rules official gives you a bad ruling, it's their fault. It's not yours. You don't get penalized for it. That's kind of the be-all, end-all. That said, I don't know, and I don't think Mark Russell addressed this, as to whether or not a player can step in and tell the official in a match play situation they're wrong or that something needs to be corrected. I don't know that dynamic. And maybe there's a difference between the European Tour in that regard, which does have a couple of match play events, versus the U.S. and the PGA Tour, even though it's the Federation of PGA Tour thing. I don't know what the difference is there. And maybe that's where the confusion lies for Jimenez and for Bradley Russell and, you know, everybody involved. But, and that's fine. That could have also been stopped by Mark Russell, who did basically nothing to squelch the situation. So, and I understand any apprehension on his part to not want to get in there in between two guys who are in the middle of battle in a one-hole different situation, the last hole of regulation. I understand all of that. So, by the wrong place, wrong time for everybody involved. And in the end, as I mentioned, I still think Keegan Bradley, even with all those extenuating circumstances and the full body of evidence, the worst for wear here, because he looks like a guy who kind of just gets a little too hot and then looks like he's going to try and be a big man. And, you know, if you're going to do that, you got to follow through on it. You got to finish it. So, yeah, I don't think it's a black eye for the sport at all. And ultimately, I don't think it's a black eye for either of the guys. I mean, I think the other day, Jimenez has love for whatever he does. And Bradley will be just fine at the end.
Yeah. And just to clean up some housekeeping issues, Mark Russell was the chief referee. The official who was there, though, was somebody from the Australasian Tour. So maybe something did get lost in translation between tours, players. I'm not sure. But he was on the walkie-talkie, so maybe Mark Russell did have some impact on that ruling, even from afar. Let's turn to the guy who won the Cadillac match play, which was Rory McIlroy, Ryan, in really impressive fashion. He comes back on 17 and 18 against Horschel, does it again against Paul Casey, and does it again against Jim Furyk. And the shot of the week and what he was able to do with a game that was not there each of those days and kind of crescendoing in that 40-foot eagle putt on Sunday was really impressive stuff, because he did not have it going.
Yeah, I find this really interesting about Rory McIlroy, because he tends to take, I'm not going to say take holes off, I think that's maybe a little too aggressive to say that, but he doesn't play 72-hole tournaments. He plays 60 really good holes when he plays at his best, and he plays 12 kind of holes. And I think that lends itself to really understanding the dynamic of match play extremely well, because unless it's a very tight match, which he had with Furyk in the semifinal, you really don't have to play every hole, every shot, and grind over it in match play. And that fits to Rory's personality, where he's not overly intense. He's just intense in the right spots. He knows where to put you away. He knows where to step on the gas. He knows where to kind of let things go sideways. And he knows that all about himself, and that's a great understanding at now 26 years old. And so, like I said, I think it works great for match play, because he knew the situation with Casey. He would literally have wasted tickets to the post fight of the century if he didn't put them away and stuck around to play the match. He knows that he got an opportunity to get away if he doesn't beat Furyk, because he knows if he gets to the final, he's got a really good chance to win this thing. And against Woodland, he knew Woodland was not playing his best. He saw from the opening shot that he was probably a little nervous, and then a couple holes later, so he wasn't playing his best, so on the second hole, third hole, and he pounced, and it was over. And I think you really have to appreciate that difference, how he plays and wins, versus how Jordan Spieth wins when he talks to two-foot putts, and it's just so intense over literally everything. And McIlroy is, and two great players just get it done a very different way, and I think that hopefully we'll leave everyone clamoring for a showdown between the two of them at Chambers Bay.
Let's hit on some guys who are playing this week. Number one, Tiger's back this week for the first time since Augusta, also the first time since he broke up with Lindsay. Look, people's personal lives are their personal lives. My take on this is that the kids, this may not come off right, but the kids and spending time with them is more important or has – maybe not more important, but has been the more important factor in this turn that we've seen with Tiger in terms of being happy in his private life, that the kids are the real catalyst for that. So I don't think there'd be any carryover effect into this week with that. What's your take?
You know, what I don't know is how, you know, will child care become an issue? I mean, at a certain point, these become practical matters. I mean, I know there's some emotional pain, I'm sure, for both of them. They've dated for almost 3 years. It's going to take time to deal with. You can't just kick someone out of your life right away. It doesn't work that way, no matter how robotic we once thought Woods was. And I think they really understood each other on a deep personal level, regardless of whatever dating relationship they had. So that's a big deal to change that dynamic a little bit. So I think that emotional baggage is there, but you have to give Tiger credit in 2009 and 2010, where at times he was able to put that completely aside inside the ropes and play some very good golf. And I think he's capable of doing that. I think it's all really kind of practical matters. Is, all right, now I'm single again. I don't have someone who can literally spend 5 hours with my kids while I play golf. Who's going to watch my kids? Is it going to be Elin? Is she going to take extra responsibility? Well, she may not want to do that. Is it going to be someone else? I mean, these are literally practical matters at this point. And I think if he can get all those things settled, and I'm sure he's already thought about this. This is probably old news for him, at least compared to how new the news is less than 24 hours old. So if that's the case, then I think he will have these things settled by the time Thursday rolls around, and he'll be in a good position to play very well. As we know, he won this the last time he played in 2013. He doesn't have the best track record here. So this is probably, I mean, other than Riviera, which he played obviously early in his career but hasn't lately, this is the course that gives him the most trouble. So I think if anything is going to hang him up this week, it's going to be the course. It's not going to be what happened off the course.
Two things on that. Number one, Lindsay was already, you know, she was living in Aspen, you know, competing all over the world. So I'd have to imagine some of those practical matters have already been in place during their whole 3 years. And for those out there who may be saying, why is this important? Well, Tiger blamed some of his short game issues on trying to spend more time with his kids and the rest of his life. So obviously with a piece of that not there, this could impact his practice regimen, because what got him back in Tiger-like shape for the Masters was actually putting in 12-hour days, which he did in the olden days and obviously did not prior to Phoenix and Torrey this year. Jordan Spieth was 16 under through his first three matches. He obviously, you know, the vagaries of match play, to steal that great phrase, helped to oust him and some, you know, bad shots at the wrong time. I would look at him, I'd look at Ricky Fowler, and I would look at Hunter Mahan as guys who in a stroke play event might have won last week, but did not because it was match play. Who else on your list do you think could have good carryover effects from last week?
I'd be really curious how Lee West. I mean, Lee Westwood is on the edge of playing really good golf again, I feel like. And you saw it earlier in the year. I mean, I think for his first six starts of the season, he finished in the top 25 and never really got out of that close. I think he's due for one more run. And I don't know if this would be the ultimate irony if Lee Westwood plays well in the Players' Championship, because he intentionally skipped it for several years in his prime thanks to Chubby Chandler. But he's playing really good golf. And he kind of got that type of game that would work, because he's not that long. You don't have to be really long. He's long enough. He's a very good ball striker. You don't have to be a perfect short game player to win. You just have to be good enough at the Players. He could putt really well at times. I think he'd be a really interesting guy to look at. I'd be curious. I'm very shocked Jim Furyk has never gotten a Players, because this seems like his tournament. This seems like the Grinders tournament. And maybe that's because this is a PTI course and he loves Harbortown also, and I think make that connection. But I'd love to see Jim Furyk pull this thing out, because I think this could kind of be his cherry on top, that if he never gets another major, this would be where he says, I deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, that could get in there. So He's got a lot riding on this if he could get into contention to finish the deal. But I like two old guys. I mean, I think those are the guys that got to take something really positive away. I don't think Gary Woodland gets a lot of positive rub for getting to the final because this course doesn't really help him. It's completely different. It's not going to fit his game all that well. I'd be shocked if he does well. So I look to the older guys and just kind of bunt it around a little bit, and hopefully they can use the local knowledge and at least in Garrick's case to get into the top of the leaderboard.
A lot of people thought that one win for Fira could just start the floodgates, and obviously ever since he's won at Harbortown, he's put himself back up there in his next start, which is a positive sign for a guy that is has that winning pedigree but had come on hard times over the last couple of years since his FedEx Cup win. Speaking of the FedEx Cup, Jimmy Walker was up there number one for so long. He's still, I think, in many people's eyes, a sleeper. As you look towards this week and who could win this week, obviously you mentioned Furyk. Who's your sleeper pick this week, and then who is ultimately your champion for this week?
Jim Walker is a great pick this week. I mean, he's a great pick every week, but I think he has that all-around game that'll do it. I can't see why that wouldn't work for anybody to have Jimmy Walker win. I mean, he's playing some of the best golf on the planet and doesn't get all that reward for it. I'd be curious if Patrick Reed, who really, really looked bad, I thought, last week, doesn't get amped up for this a little bit. And he's streaky. When he's great, he's great. When he's not, he's... But I'd be very interested in Reed because I think he kind of has a Lee Westwood quality to him where he can... He's basically the American Bulldog, where he can go out, play really well. He's not all that long. He's just kind of good enough at everything else. And when he gets into contention, he can put it away. So if I had to pick underdog, I would go with you with Jimmy Walker because he never seems to be on the top of anyone's list or the tip of anyone's tongue. And I think Patrick Reed, this would be kind of his spot where this would be a very Patrick Reed kind of win where – he could go, I am a top five player in the world. We all go, but this isn't a major. And then we all start the controversy all over again. So I like those two guys.
And for me, as I look at this week, I really like Ricky Fowler and I really like Jordan Spieth. Obviously, both of us were right with Spieth as a champion. At Augusta, I really like what I saw out of Ricky last week, and Spieth obviously is still playing some great golf. I think that Justin Thomas, who got into the field because Victor Dubuis' son withdrew, here's a guy that really has nothing to lose. He and Daniel Berger locked up their cards for next year, really playing with house money right now. Those are two guys that can hit it a long ways, that are fairly accurate when they're on, and as I said, are playing with house money. They could really make a run this week, I think. They truly have absolutely nothing to lose for the rest of this season and can compete for their first win and the playoffs, which would be really heady stuff for them.
I mean, in the long-term play, I like Justin Thomas more than Daniel Berger, but I think this week I would like Daniel Berger more than Justin Thomas because he's playing really good golf. He's been in the spot. He's been in closer to the win, obviously, than Justin Thomas has, getting in that playoff with Patrick Harrington at Honda. For whatever reason, he seems to play well all four rounds, and Justin Thomas just does not. He usually stands on one of the third or fourth rounds, or both, for that matter. He doesn't figure out his weekend routine on the PGA Tour. So I think between the two, I love Daniel Berger's game. That's another great name to think about. He's an all-around great player, and I think he would be the youngest player's champion by like 2 or 3 years. Because how old was Adam Scott when he won in 2004 or 2005? Like 25 years old or something like that. So I think he would easily be the youngest player's champion. That would be a pretty cool accomplishment for a guy who's come a long way and suddenly on people's radars this year.
The dog's barking. Our time is up. Ryan Ballingy, I thank you as always for your time here on Teeing It Up.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
Take care. And that is it for Teeing It Up. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.